You're listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. Hosted by business and political expert Jay Amernick, political visionary and entrepreneur Rick Raddatz, and me, journalist in all media Heather Vail, The Political Fix reveals the answers we're all looking for. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern at politicalfixradio.com. And welcome to The Political Fix on this Wednesday, October 29th. We have gone through another month already. What the heck is happening? Welcome to the show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm here with my co-hosts Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. Jay's a strategic planner who helps his clients create and implement plans, tactics, goals, and benchmarks, and he's also the bridge in Nevada for Israeli companies expanding business in the U.S. He has a development lab as well that creates smartphone apps and inventions. Rick Raddatz is a serial entrepreneur and internet marketer with a degree in philosophy. His political development is called The Solution, which is to cap and prioritize government spending. I'm Heather Vail, also known as The Unwrapper, an interviewer and journalist in all media, TV, radio, print, and online. Hey, guys, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
So where did October go?
October went into the dustbin of history is where it went. Where it goes every year.
The fall of Jay. The fall of Jay.
It's all over.
Jay's getting upset.
No, actually, I'm not getting upset. I'm actually having an okay fall. I'm being very productive. Not having as much fun as I had during the summer of Jay, but I'm productive.
Okay, well.
Which is rewarding in its own
Yes,
way.
There's value in being productive. Imagine that.
So they tell me.
Yeah. So, Rick, how's your week been going?
Good.
Yeah.
That's
all right.
Well. Can you elaborate?
I'm the philosopher guy. I'm not into all this bantering stuff. Let's get to the issue of the day.
No, let's get to the solution. Tell us what the solution is.
The solution is to cap and prioritize government spending. I'm setting the context for the next paragraph.
Okay,
we're going to cap and prioritize government spending, meaning we're going to cap the government just like the right wants, very limited, nice and tight. And the way to make that politically viable is to take the money that's left, trillions of dollars, and prioritize it, rank it from top to bottom. And the best way to do that is to take the social spending money and give it to the states and have every state prioritize their portion. That'll create 50 different experiments for how best to prioritize that money, how best to help people. And through constant competition, we will find better and better ways to help people over time. And so this is the union of the limited government the right wants and the pursuit of social justice, helping people who need help most that the left wants. So this is the solution, the political solution, the political fix. Cap and prioritize.
Yes, and somehow everyone's going to accept that and move forward with it. How are you going to convince them?
There's going to be an enlightenment.
That's what this show is about.
An enlightenment. Yeah. An enlightenment. Okay.
It happened once before. Between the years 1550 and 1804 is considered the age of enlightenment. And I call it the first age of enlightenment because if we take the ideas they had then about politics, okay, capitalism, democracy, the constitutional republic is a better term, and a strong national defense, and we take those same ideas and apply it to social justice and to sustainability, we end up with the cap and prioritize and cap and trade ideas, which is what we have to add on to the top of government that we have today.
Yeah, so, okay.
This is the second enlightenment.
That's a very spiritual statement to make.
No. See, a lot of people today use the word enlightenment to mean, woo.
Yeah.
Cool. Hey, no. yes. I'm not a woo-woo person. I tend to attract woo-woo people because they see the integrity and the honesty and they value those kind of, they value strong opinions expressed in a comfortable kind of way. But I am not a woo-woo person myself. And so the enlightenment, that word has been pushed off to this spiritual side in today's culture. But really it means just you come to a better understanding of the world. That's all it really means. Only here we're grounding this enlightenment, second enlightenment, in reality, which is kind of the opposite of the spiritual belief structures that people have.
Okay. Well, yin and yang. You got the spiritual.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go, bastardizing philosophy again. That's a whole other philosophy. Male and female. And there's male in the female and female in the male. Yes, that's a whole other slice of things. Yes, thank you.
Yes. All right. So you wanted to mention that elections are coming up, and how does that affect our world if cap and prioritize the solution?
I predict it'll make no difference whatsoever. That's my prediction.
See, that's what I thought you'd say.
Yeah.
Because a few months ago, when we had
this prediction.
No, everyone makes predictions. My prediction is that everyone else's predictions don't matter, and neither does the election. Okay, because we're whether left or right wins, we're still in divided government. We're still trending down the same path, the path that leads to Greece, the path that leads to a cliff, the path that leads to destruction. So we have to limit government and then make it politically viable. We have to prioritize spending, cap and prioritize. So the election doesn't matter. That's my prediction.
So you're saying that no matter who gets in, we're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. Now, we may not take real action until we get closer to the cliff. We may have to fall over the cliff four times before we actually take action. Who knows? So the best that can happen is that we get closer to the cliff, ironically.
So the act of falling over the cliff prompts enlightenment. Interesting.
Yes, that's a pretty tried and true mechanism. In fact, evolution is based on that. The animals, the genes that don't work as well, given reality, fade away, and the ones that work great live on and prosper and multiply, and eventually discover amazing things through that process. And humans do the same thing. It's a little bit faster because we use our mind instead of just statistics playing out over billions of years. We use actual conscious thought to accelerate the process of discovery and enlightenment. But it's the same process, which is trial and error.
Okay. Speaking of trial and error, that fits in nicely with the top story today. You guys want to hear it?
Why not?
No.
Okay.
Sure. Let's do it.
Okay. An unmanned commercial supply rocket headed for the International Space Station exploded moments after liftoff yesterday evening, with debris falling in flames over the launch site in Virginia. No injuries were reported following the first catastrophic launch in NASA's commercial spaceflight effort. The accident is expected to draw criticism over the space agency's growing reliance on private U.S. companies in this post-shuttle era. NASA is paying billions of dollars to Orbital Sciences and the SpaceX company to make station deliveries, and it's counting on SpaceX and Boeing to start flying U.S. astronauts to the orbiting lab as early as 2017. This was the fourth flight by Orbital Sciences to the orbiting lab. The Orbital Sciences Antares rocket blew up over the beachside launch complex at Wallops Island. The company said everyone at the site had been accounted for, and the damage appeared to be limited to the facilities. Nothing on the lost flight was urgently needed by the six people who are currently living on the 260-mile-high space station, according to officials. Orbital Sciences Executive Vice President Frank Culbertson said things began to go wrong 10 to 12 seconds into the flight, and it was all over in 20 seconds when what was left of the rocket came crashing down. He said he believes the range safety staff sent a destruct signal before it hit the ground. Bill Robel, who's the director of NASA's Wallops Flight Facility, said crews were letting the fires burn out late last night, and they set up a perimeter to contain the flames in the darkness. Now, this was the second launch attempt for the mission. Monday evening's try was thwarted by a stray sailboat in the rocket's danger zone. The restrictions are in case of just such an accident, like the one that occurred yesterday. Culbertson said he couldn't guess how long it will take to determine the cause of the accident and to make repairs to the launch pad. He said the company carried insurance on the mission, which he valued at more than $200 million, not counting repair costs. He stressed that it was too soon to know whether the Russian-built engines that were modified for the Antares and extensively tested were to blame. This Wallops facility is pretty small compared to NASA's major centers, like those that are in Florida, Texas, and California, but it became in the public spotlight last September 2013 with a NASA moonshot and the first Cygnus launch to the space station. Just coincidentally, the Russian space agency was proceeding with its own supply run today, and that was planned well before the U.S. accident. SpaceX is scheduled to launch another Dragon supply ship from Cape Canaveral in December. The two Americans, three Russians, and one German who are living aboard the space station were watching a live video feed from Mission Control, and they saw the whole thing happen. Until yesterday, all the supply missions had been near flawless by both the Virginia-based Orbital Sciences and California-based SpaceX, which is founded by billionaire Elon Musk. The explosion hit Orbital Sciences' stock, though, and it fell more than 15% in after-hours trading. So, there you have it. Government letting go of control. Lots of controversy over where this should go, but what do you guys think? Jay?
Well, there, as the story suggests, there have been several almost flawless supply runs to the space station. This is one where it didn't work out so well. So that's to be expected, that there are going to be problems. And just thank God nobody was hurt and nobody was on the ship and nobody needed urgently what was being sent to them. But to criticize a privatization of that portion of NASA's program is foolish, and people are doing it in my estimation, for some kind of political gain to say, see, this is what happens when the private sector takes over.
Okay. Here's what happens when the private sector takes over. When the private sector takes over, a rocket ship blows up, and we lose a couple $100 million. When NASA has a rocket ship blows up, it's a couple $1 billion. Okay, so that's progress. Okay, we're wasting less money on space. That is progress right there.
Yeah. Oh, I take exception to saying wasting. I think it's important, and we don't. And as far as it being, it's 5% of our annual budget. It's really not much at all. And what we get out of it, there's a great deal more we get out of NASA than just that. There's a lot of photography that can help us with weather trends. It helps us with when there's a natural disaster or a man-made disaster for that matter. Sort of getting a good view of it and the lay of the land.
Okay, so Jay, you think NASA's doing valuable?
I'm a huge fan of NASA. Yeah, but if they felt the need to privatize this portion of it, they had a good reason for it, and you know, look, one foul up. I mean, if we went and saw all NASA's original foul ups, you know, we would have stopped it when the capsule blew up, when the rocket blew up on the pad with Grissom and the two other astronauts whose names escape me at this moment, but you know, that was a huge thing, and there were calls to shut down the whole program, but they didn't, and thank God they didn't, because a couple years later we ended up landing a man on the moon.
What I find amazing is that you can actually insure a rocket launch. I mean, a little progressive. Yeah, I like to insure my rocket launch.
It's probably Lloyd's of London. They will underwrite almost anything. In the world of property.
Yeah, I wonder what that bill is, because
not just the launch; it's the whole mission was insured.
Sure.
So,
I buy that.
Yeah,
technically, I think maybe even the federal government can underwrite it. I'm not sure, but they probably go to someone like Lloyd's of London. That's the go-to for that sort of unusual type of thing.
Yeah, I'm sure there's an absolutely huge premium. I mean, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it's like a third of the cost is insurance. I have no idea.
It can't be that. No, because that wouldn't be worth it to them.
Like, what are the odds of a rocket ship blowing up, especially that they're always customizing it, doing something different to it each time, right? So it's like...
apparently not that much. One out of ten?
Yeah, but...
And we don't really do them that often.
You have to pay... If it's a one out of ten chance, and it's a very variable chance, I mean, you can have a bad streak there and get three in a row. So you got to calculate all that risk into the insurance rates.
Of course.
So that's an interesting thing to look up is what's the price of insurance for a rocket launch?
Right.
Okay.
Well,
so,
Rick,
is this not an example of cap and prioritize? Because obviously someone said, hey, look, let's put a cap on government spending for space programs and let's prioritize what we're going to do with it. And hey, let's privatize it because that's a good way to prioritize.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, we lost a couple $100 million here and private insurance paid for it, as opposed to losing a whole lot more if the government was doing it. It's all part of, you know, making spending more efficient. And I've noticed that they have two different suppliers here, you know, or possibly three, depending on how you count it. So, you know, there's even competition going on amongst the government spending here. I think it's a great effort.
Okay, cool. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we are going to have Rick's rant, because Rick is going to be leaving us early, so we're going to get the rant right away. It's going to be lots of fun. I know he's all riled up already, so we'll be right back with you in a few minutes on The Political Fix. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail, here with my co-hosts Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. Before the break, we were talking about NASA privatizing some of their services and a rocket blowing up, but apparently not a big deal, according to Rick and Jay, because we lost a lot less money than we would have if it was a government program.
Heather, I have stats for you on this. You ready?
Okay, cool. Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, the rocket launch insurance market is a healthy, competitive market, apparently. There are several suppliers of rocket insurance, and it's a $3.5 billion industry.
Okay.
And they paid out $835 million in losses, meaning a gross profit of $2.6 billion. Now, look at those numbers. A $3.5 billion industry with a $2.6 billion profit.
Which
okay, and the reason why is because any particular launch is so unknowable, so different than the last one, that they have to have this huge premium, and they pay it because what else are they going to do? But the profit is just out of this sight. In 2007, the industry made a little bit less than they took in, so that speaks to the variability, and that justifies their windfall profits in the other years. So it's a $3.5 billion industry with $2.6 billion in profit.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. Okay.
Who knew?
Yeah.
So in general, you guys are in favor of privatization if it achieves a prioritizing goal?
I'm for whatever works. If it works, great. If it doesn't work, not. I'm not for anything ideologically one way or the other, except for something that I'm about efficacy. And if it works, and actually just to clarify, it's not that we didn't think a rocket blowing up wasn't a big deal. We didn't think that Rick, correct me if I'm wrong, the fervor over this is a disaster when we privatize was a big deal.
That's what I'm saying.
A rocket blowing up is a big deal.
Yeah, anyone who's arguing that this is a failure of privatization is just off their nuts. Or they're trying to game the system and win their own political points, as Jay mentioned earlier.
Yes.
So speaking of winning political points, we were having a slight discussion off the air. So it's election week. There's some debate whether there's going to be a difference. I mean, Rick already said it doesn't matter who wins. We're heading over the cliff anyhow. So don't bother voting, says Rick. I know that Jay is a big fan of getting out there and voting and having your say. So a little bit of discrepancy there. But Jay, you also mentioned during the break that in this particular election, maybe it won't make such a big difference who gets elected because, for example, locally here in Nevada, it's really a lot of judges that are being voted for.
Yeah. No, but there are some big. The margin tax is a big thing. It's in my recollection probably one of the biggest referendums that's been on the ballot here in Nevada since I've lived here. And yes, voting for your member of Congress is a big deal. Now, of course, because cap and prioritize, Rick, is not yet a part of the national discussion.
Mm-hmm.
That's why as it pertains to CNP, that's why it's not going to make a big deal. But for other things, it's important.
Yeah. Okay, so let's have our outside perspective segment today. This is what we like to call Rick's rant, where Rick gets to have his say about what he thinks might be going on in the world of politics. Take it away, Rick.
Thank you. Well, my rant today, we've kind of hinted on it twice already, unavoidably, because this is election week coming up soon here. And my rant today is about the horse race and the focus on the horse race. Who's going to win, the left or the right, this senator or that senator, et cetera. And it's fun. Okay, the horse race is fun. It's fun to watch, just like any sporting event. This is a sport, essentially. It's, you know, you don't know who's going to win, so it's kind of that mystery adds a very authentic form of drama. And we go to the movies to get inauthentic drama, and they try to make it as authentic as they can, and they do an amazing job of it. Sporting events are so popular because it's real drama. You don't know what's going to happen, and that's why everyone loves the horse race. But the horse race doesn't matter. That's the rant. The horse race doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all, because even if you get one side getting total power, what are they going to do? They're going to abuse that power, and they're going to get out of power real soon, and same with the other side. And so that's why we have divided government so much, because we're in this quandary. We don't know what to do, okay? Well, when I say we, I mean most people don't know what to do. Here on this show, we know what to do, cap and prioritize. And cap and prioritize is not about the next election. It's not going to help anyone win the next election. This is about another era of enlightenment, another era where we, the people, discuss things and figure things out and say, okay, if ideas compete in government, that's a good thing. Okay, cap and prioritize. So that's the true important thing to focus on, cap and prioritize. It's a long-term thing. The short-term horse race is fun. Enjoy election night with your bowl of popcorn and yelling at the TV. But don't think it really matters. It doesn't.
Okay, well, as far as horse races go, I mean, as we mentioned, there's a lot of judges running for election here locally in Nevada, and they're not left or right. They're nonpartisan. So
No.
Seriously?
Hang on. They run on a nonpartisan ticket. They are, however, some of them are very, I know I'm not going to mention any names. I know some
judges
of them
are supposed to be neutral. Neutral.
That is fine.
No,
judges are not neutral. Are you kidding me? They're not even supposed to be neutral. What does neutral mean?
It means
the whole idea of blind justice is silly.
Okay, but that's the basis of the justice system. It's supposed to be blind. It's supposed to be blind.
No, the basis is innocent until proven guilty.
You use judgment. Judgment means to identify things and separate things and draw lines. And to take a look at the world and see what's going on and see how it all fits in together.
But not from a tainted perspective of being left or right. That would not be correct.
No, of course it is.
No. Heather is right on an ideal utopian level.
They
do bring their personal experience to it sometimes. And sometimes they get busted for it, quite frankly, and
always.
But I know some judges that are that again run on the nonpartisan ticket, but are very engaged in one party or the other.
Yeah, well, the of course there's a kind of a bell curve, there's a spectrum, but the unavoidably, especially when the country is divided, and judges are either elected or appointed, which pulls in our divide either way. You're going to have judges that are, think of it this way. The more passionate you are about politics, about making government work, about helping people and so on, the more likely you want to be involved, right? Right. And that you can be involved a thousand different ways. And one of them is being a judge. So the people who are judges, they're more concerned than the average folk about how the system works. Which means that they're more politically involved, unavoidably. And so even though some judges are more professional than others, judging as a whole is still very political, unavoidably so, and that's okay.
If I'm walking down the strip in Las Vegas and I get raped, I think I want a left-wing judge. So do I get to choose?
To some degree, you can choose. The government does what they can to minimize that. And Jay would know more about this than I would, but that if you go into this district, you're going to get this pool of judges, and they lean, you know, two-thirds to the left. And over in this pool, it's two-thirds to the right, or whatever. And so you can kind of play that game.
It would most likely be up to your attorney to try to get a different venue if the judge was in fact, like, you know, it depends on the judge. I wouldn't say it's a left-wing or right-wing judge that prosecutes rape more than another.
It is because the right wing perspective starts to overlap into what was she wearing, what did she do, did she provoke it? Whereas
not from a judicial stance, it's wrong. not from a judicial standpoint. I've rarely seen a situation where the judge got away with it. Has said something along those lines, or made his decision based upon that. Now, the defense is always going to try to put the victim on trial. That's what they do. It's whether or not the judge, listens to it. I don't know that there's any statistic that says that a right-wing judge or a left-wing judge. But again, let's just say it's a judge that you know in the past has been not favorable to rape victims. Your attorney would then try to get a different venue or a different department in that court. That would be my suggestion anyway. And if not, you know, you always have the possibility of a mistrial or trying it in civil court if he's not found criminally guilty.
Okay, catch this, guys. In Michigan, there's a big deal about limiting insurance from providing abortion, even in the case of rape, and so that's creating the other side of the argument to say, well, look, then people are going to have to buy specially designed rape insurance on the private market. So we have rape insurance as a thing.
Wow.
Does it fall under health insurance or does it
I think the issue here is that now that health insurance is more and more controlled by the government,
right,
things like abortion become a bigger issue when it should be just a private marketplace deciding this issue. And if the government's not going to fund abortions, which is a pretty normal thing for them to end up at, then private industry is going to have to add a supplemental insurance for women that want to fund abortions in this case, rape.
It doesn't have to be a supplemental. It could just be a simple rider on their health insurance.
That you could never foresee. That's something that you wouldn't even want to get your head around.
That's the purpose of insurance, for things that you can't recognize.
Because we know when you go out driving in your car that there's a statistical chance you may be in an accident. That's not the same as thinking if I walk down the street, there's a statistical chance I might get raped and I might end up pregnant, and I may or may not want an abortion at that point, depending on how traumatic the experience was. So therefore, I should have insurance to cover that remote traumatic.
That's the whole point of insurance, is to cover remote things that you can't imagine.
Nothing's as remote and emotionally based as that.
Car accidents
are not fraught with emotion and trauma in the same way.
Yes, they are, actually.
No, they're not.
Car accident's not traumatic?
Not in the same way as rape. No.
Okay.
There's an emotional factor. My car was rear-ended. It was not as traumatic as being raped.
Hang on, Heather,
you missed the double attack there. Okay.
Rick was being dirty. Rick was working blue before 5 p.m.
It's the same thing. I just proved it right there. Rear-ending.
Heather, I'm going to see if I can slightly bring you back to earth. There are in insurance, there are riders and things like that. There's a dread disease rider. There are things that, you know, it's special cancer insurance, which falls under the category of a dread disease.
Is there a special serial killer rider? Like if I get killed by a serial killer as opposed to just a random accident, do I need an extra special rider for that?
No, because that doesn't fall under health insurance. That falls under life insurance.
Life insurance doesn't have these riders, just health insurance. That's
life insurance has different riders, but health insurance has life insurance is based on did he die or didn't he? If he's still alive, he doesn't qualify for life insurance for a payout. Okay, if the individual has deceased. And there are some riders. There's a suicide rider and things like that that life insurance companies won't pay if the individual commits suicide within 3 years, I believe, of getting the insurance.
Okay, but if they die any other way, it's irrelevant.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, the riders on life insurance have to do with sort of how things are paid out and. How premiums are paid and things like that. You can get
It's only health insurance that we're playing with this extreme emotional possibility.
Why would life insurance have a rape rider in it?
See, no, there's no other insurance we can think of that has that emotional component.
To the extent that you're talking about, first of all, they're all No, it's still statistical. There is still a statistical possibility of someone walking down the street getting raped, getting pregnant, and then not, and then deciding whether or not they want to have that abortion or not.
And there's not a single other, there's not a single other circumstance you can come up with that is fraught with so many different traumatic emotional experiences. First, the trauma of being raped.
Second, the trauma. Hang on. No, Heather, I'm going to try to bring you back to earth here. You're missing.
I think we need to take a break. We're going to take a break. We'll come right back, and then Jay's going to bring me back to earth. So we'll be right back with you on the political thing.
Major Tom.
Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vale here with Major Tom and Jay Amernick, my co-host, Major Tom, a.k.a. Rick Raddatz. Now, before the break, we were having a bit of an argument over rape and ensuring rape because apparently in certain states with abortion not being, with abortion being frowned upon, basically, they're talking about different clauses. Now, here's my point. When you're talking about rape and someone getting pregnant from rape and coming to the decision whether or not they're going to abort that fetus based on the fact that it was rape, there's not a single other crime or accident or incident you can think of that has that level of emotional trauma. Because first of all, you're taking an act that's the most intimate act in the world and turning it into something violent and dirty. Second of all, you're dealing with a mother and child and the emotional decision whether or not to get rid of it. And you couple those two together, that's like, you can't,
okay,
you can't
Heather,
equate that
Heather,
to anything
Heather,
else.
Heather, Heather.
Hang on,
Jay, Jay, no, Heather.
All right,
Heather.
Okay. All right, Rick. Okay. Rick's turn.
Because the first segment was you and you two arguing. Now, here's my point on this.
Okay.
You're right. It is the most emotional thing you could possibly imagine. But so what? Just because of that emotional, it doesn't mean that there shouldn't be insurance for it if government insurance for political reasons can't cover it.
So you're saying women need to think about the possibility that they're going to be raped and decide whether or not they want to have insurance.
If they want to live in the real world, yes.
Yeah. Right. The writer simply asks this, or the insurance agent would ask this, do you want a rider that covers an abortion in the case of rape? Yes or no? Not all the emotional and traumatic ramifications of it. It's simply that is what is going to be asked about the rider. The rider isn't going to go into their feelings. And again, there may be a thing where the rider covers counseling for that as well. I don't know. This seems to be
that would be a good idea.
But again, that may be covered in just a general mental wellness provision in your insurance policy, and not have to be special for that. This is because of the political ramifications of it.
Well, and let's be clear: the reason this is a political issue is because many people, honestly disagree with other people on whether or not a fetus is really murder. Because at some point, the fetus is a baby and deserves the protection of individual rights. Okay, and it should be protected against harm by anybody, including the mother. And at some point earlier, it doesn't even exist. So someplace in between, society has to draw a line. And
well,
where
they've
we draw
tried
line,
to draw lines. They've made parameters as to this many weeks.
Right.
And so.
Yes, but that line is arbitrary. Okay, you can argue arbitrary in the sense of we can't agree as a society. Okay, so any one person thinks it's very clear. It's very clearly this or that, or some people aren't sure, maybe. But but as a society, it's unclear where we're going to draw the line, and so it's always going to be a fight, always, always, always.
Yeah, which is I think they've actually come up with a fairly reasoned response, which is for religious reasons, some people believe that it is murder. Okay, so because of the First Amendment, government can't pay for it. So basically what it's saying is that, okay, great, you think it's murder, that's your belief, you can't tell person B that they have to believe that as well. So the line is drawn that government, it is legal, yet government will not pay for it. That is the line drawn.
All right. So now we've got inside perspective with Jay Amernick. Let's here, I know that Jay was excited about sharing his segment today, so let's
Well, mainly because I thought Rick wasn't going to be here. So this actually sort of ties in a little bit to the election concept. People all the time will talk about how lazy Congress is. Okay, so and they don't work, and here they only took they only were in session this many weeks, and they took this much time off. First of all, let me say that is complete and utter nonsense. Members of Congress are literally working 24 hours a day every day.
No.
Hang on, let me finish.
Literally means something different.
Okay, all right, okay. Figuratively, 24 hours a day.
Yes.
There, forgive me. Forgive me for my dramatic license. Okay, they are in session. Whether they get work done, whether there's gridlock, that's a different story. That's a discussion for another time. They are still there. And by the way, once they are out of session for that day, believe me, they are invited. Heather, you know this, when we go out and network. There's the 9-to-5 job, and then there's the 5-to-9 job. They have that as well, and they are literally going from event to event to speaking to speaking to speaking. And then maybe they get to get on a plane, fly back to their district, or in the case of a senator, their state, and then they spend all that time there in their district office, in their local office, meeting with constituents, meeting with people, going out, having events, having town hall meetings, again, doing the same thing, going to events, speaking the whole nine yards, sometimes campaigning as well. Believe me, they are working a whole lot. Just because they're not in session does not mean they're not working on our behalf. Whether you agree with them politically or not, they are out there working. There's no member of Congress that says, oh, hey, I'm going back to my district. Time to you know, get out the Xbox and really take on Call of Duty.
Oh, come on. I'm sure they have personal downtime as well.
They do, because they spend time with their families. But I'm telling you, they are incredibly spread thin and overcommitted.
Okay. Rick?
Well, yeah. I agree.
And what's the point, right?
Well, I'll tell you my point.
I think there is a good point here in that I think Jay's point is that blaming Congress for doing nothing or whatever is unfounded. They're working hard, and they're all working under the same incentives or different incentives depending on the party, and so it's not a question of working hard. In other words, I think if you take this point and extend it one layer deeper, we can say that electing better politicians, okay, better, whatever that means, isn't the solution. Okay, the solution has to be changing the incentives under which they make decisions and make progress. And that's what cap and prioritize is all about. So, and I'll also say that if I were elected to the Congress, I would not be working that hard. Okay, I would be voting no on everything until we get cap and prioritize. So whatever goofy thing they want, I'll say, sure, I'll vote for it after we get cap and prioritize. And so I would have a very easy job. I'd just not take any meetings, not go to any events. I would get reelected. Because my pledge to the people would be, I'm voting no until we cap and prioritize. Because everything should be slowed down until we cap and prioritize. So Medal of Honor winner, no. Nothing gets a yes vote
from
me.
That sounds like an ultimatum.
Nothing gets a yes vote from me until
Utter winner. Until
cap and prioritize. And then we can have good government. Then we can make decisions on everything because we'll have the right structural incentives.
Okay, it's like a 5-year-old throwing a tantrum. No. Yeah. Not till I get my way. No.
That's what we need. And the people have to throw a tantrum. We, the people, have to throw a tantrum. Elect me for Congress in 2020. Okay. And I'll vote no on everything until we get cap and prioritize. Now,
is that
going to
be your platform? Like, what a platform!
Yeah,
I will
yes
vote
no
on everything.
No. My platform is say yes to no.
Okay,
that's actually funny.
That's cute.
Okay, so we have a member of Congress here in Nevada who has done something similar. He hasn't voted no on everything. He's voted no on a great deal he's voted no on almost every spending bill, with the exception of foreign aid, I believe, and he's coming under scrutiny for that. So Rick had to leave the call, but it is actually very difficult to not run on that platform, but it's very difficult to get reelected on that platform.
Yeah. So did the one in Nevada get reelected?
Well, we'll find out next week.
Oh, okay. So he's only been in for one term.
Yes, But he's been around. He's been around Nevada politics for quite some time. He was a state senator and everything like that.
Okay, and his reason for voting no on almost everything is what?
On spending bills.
He just doesn't want the government to continue spending too much.
He believes in cap. I have not personally had the discussion with him about prioritize, but he certainly believes in capping spending. Okay. He's voted for military spending. He's voted for I believe foreign aid. I have to double check on that. But overall, just the pork barrel, the things like that, he has voted for the most part against.
Okay, and people don't like that because why?
Some people don't like it, but that's his opponent is saying, bourgeois, I disagree, and this is why they get nothing done, and he's done this and that, and then of course there are all distortions too on both sides, but that's the basis is, you see what saying no gets you and standing in the way, being a do nothing stand in the way gridlock Congress does, I'm different.
Okay. All right. We're going to take one final short break and then we'll come back and wrap it up on the Political Fix. Welcome back to the Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail here with one of my co-hosts, Jay Amernick, because Major Tom had to blast off. And hopefully his rocket will not explode and he'll be back with us next week.
Right. Toy, toy.
So all right. So, Jay, you know, Rick did make the point that the world is talking about, or the nation, not the world, but the nation is talking about elections this week. And we've talked about it off and on throughout the show. But, you know, as opposed to Rick, I know that you think that people should get out and vote. Now, kind of give us some of your reasonings about why you think it's important and why their vote actually will make a difference.
Okay, well, it certainly does. Actually, you can see it on, if you watch the news tonight, the local news, or not tonight, no, sorry, excuse me, next Tuesday night, if you watch the local news, you will see, you know, some of the local elections, especially the judges. You'll see where, like, literally it'll be, you know, 4,502 votes, right? One of those was your vote. No, very rarely it does not come down to one or two votes, but because that would be well within the margin of error. But it's still, you see where your vote is counted and where it makes a difference. And even if it's not what someone would deem an important election, where you don't think you really have a dog in the race, where you don't think it's going to matter one way or the other, it's still your civic duty. And it's still, and just quite frankly, it's good practice for when the time does come where it's a big, big deal to you.
Okay. So with members of Congress, people pay attention to what their stance is, what they're going to bring or not bring. In the case of judges, though, we've mentioned them a few times. How do people actually decide what judges they're going to vote for? Because it's not like we keep an eye on, oh, this is what this judge accomplished this year, and that one didn't.
Some people do. And again, there's certain things right now. I don't want to mention, you know, names or anything like that, but there's a sort of a thing going on here in Nevada now with this, I believe it's called Uber, this driving thing.
Yeah.
The taxi union is obviously opposed to it, which is their right to be opposed to it. However, it seems like there's some weird things going on. It seems like someone from the taxi authority pulled over an Uber driver. This was in the news yesterday. I don't know all the details of it. And two plainclothes ski mask wearing police officers were in there with them. Now that sounds a little bit scary. This is coming before one of the judges who's actually up for re-election. And if this is something that's very important to you, you should watch and see how this judge sides. If somehow the unions have gotten to him and he's going to go one way or the other side has gotten to him, and you know, whatever side you're on, this judge is going to be making a decision based on this case.
Okay.
And he's up for re-election.
In Las Vegas, would it not be safer to side with the union?
It's not a matter of being said. The whole point is the judge should be immune from that.
Should be. Should. See, this was my point earlier. Should be.
Right.
Yes, but you guys are saying, no, they're not. So
No. Rick said that to an extent they are, but we'll see. And if he's not immune to it, then it's up to everyone who's on the other side of it to say to throw a spotlight on it and say, hey, look at what this guy did, and then follow the money, by the way, and see who contributed to his campaign, which is public, and see if it was the taxi cab union gave, you know, $5,000 or whatever. I don't know what the minimums are or maximums.
And that is not allowed, according to what you've said before.
No. They can, but what cannot happen, judicial works differently than legislative, much differently, and especially on the local level here. However, if there is malfeasance, if in fact the judge received a great deal of money from the taxi cab, I can't remember the exact name of the taxi cab union, forgive me, a great deal of money from them, he should then recuse himself and say, by the way, I'm very close with the people who ran this operation with the plainclothes policeman and the taxi cab authority. And the judge should say, I can't do this because they were contributors to my campaign. I know, you know, Bill Jones well, and I can't be a part of it. If it turns out he does not recuse himself and goes ahead with it and then sides with the taxi cab community, and again, I'm just using this as an example. I don't know whether he's taken money from them or not. I have no idea. I just want to be very clear about that. This is all hypothetical. Then the other side has the cause to go after him and say, you know, you should have recused yourself and then call for a mistrial. Or and then inversely go to the public and say, look at what this guy did, vote him out.
Yeah. See, I kind of think that the judges, a lot of people will vote on the judges just based on whether they saw his sign or her sign more often than the other ones. I mean, Stephanie Miley, I have heard her ad on the radio I don't know how many times, and she's got police officers and military endorsing her, and she's got signs all over the place. And so, you know, if I were going to vote, and I don't because I'm Canadian, just to make that clear, if I got to the point of seeing the ballot and I saw her name and all these other names that I'd never heard of, you know, my human nature would kick in and I would just tick off her name because I'm just more aware of her.
Right. And well, and this would be to Rick's point as well, that they are counting on that. They are 100% counting on the fact that you're not going to read the brochure, the booklet you get in the mail that says I'm Judge A or I'm running for this seat and I believe in A, B, and C. They are banking on you not reading that. They are really hoping you don't read that, and they're hoping you see the sign with, you know, her pretty face, and you're going to remember, oh, Stephanie Miley, I remember that name. I'm going to vote for her. Now, I'm not endorsing her or not endorsing her, just again, be very clear. I want to be very clear. We just use that as an example.
Yes.
But yes, you are 100% correct that name recognition, especially on these, on some of these lower contests, really, really make a difference. You know, this is, by the way, one of the reasons why incumbents do so well, especially in Congress. They do so well because you've heard the name, for instance, Dina Titus, Joe Heck, Stephen Horsford, for so long. They're in the news every day that you hear the name. Who's running against them? And if it's not somebody sort of like a big contest would be, okay, so Harry Reid, obviously, is probably the most recognizable name in Nevada politics. He's the Senate Majority Leader. He's been around for a very long time. If somebody runs, the person who ran against him last time was almost a no-name. And because of that, there was, again, no name recognition, and not to mention she was, you know, out there as a candidate. Not that I'm endorsing Senator Reid either. I'm just, you know.
Okay, but basically, it boils down to who's the best marketer.
Well, yes. I mean, technically, that's what a political campaign is a form of marketing. You're marketing yourself as the candidate and your platform.
And if you have the most effective marketing campaign, then chances are you're going to get voted in.
Yes, yes and no. There are other variables as well. You know, the other thing would be a debate. So, you know, what's really interesting is you actually very rarely see this. You see it sometimes in ads. And I don't know that they do so well. Coke doing an ad where they sort of make fun of Pepsi, or Pepsi doing an ad where they make fun of Coke or something like that. I don't know that those ads are super effective. I think in general, people like to see someone come out. They like to see Heather come out and say, "This is what I offer as your candidate." Not, "I'm not this." And increasingly over the years, I mean, I think we've seen that. I think certainly in the presidential election, I think you had a lot of people who voted against Barack Obama, against Mitt Romney. And there are people that vote for them. There's no doubt about that. And I think we really, for the first time I can really remember seeing it was George W. Bush versus John Kerry. There was some. People weren't so happy with President Bush at the time, but they didn't necessarily like care. There was a lot of voting against that, and that's
so Kerry got votes just because he was not Bush, and whoever else was running would have equally got those votes.
Right, and by the way, there's always been a certain percentage of the electorate that's going to do that. That's just going to say, "I don't care who, so and so party puts up. I'm voting for the other guy. I don't." It doesn't matter who it is. I'm not going to vote. They always have that.
Yeah.
And then within that, you're going to have people who are divided. I voted for my candidate, or I voted against the other guy. That's always going to be sort of the nature of it, which is a weird thing, because if you think about it in marketing, I don't drink Coke. I'm not saying I drink Coke, but I'm saying I don't drink Coke just to shove it in Pepsi's face.
Well, I
don't go to the Pepsi bottling company, to open up a bottle of Coke outside and be like, "Yeah, up yours."
Right, but a more modern example is Samsung marketing against Apple. Yep. Now, in that case, there are Android users who specifically want to take a dig at Apple. Like, they're very emotional about it. Yep. So that in that case, that is what's going on.
Yeah. It,
they're buying Samsung to take a dig at Apple. Now, I have a Samsung. My boyfriend has an iPhone. I am not, I'm neutral. I like them both. But
I did not
buy a Samsung to stick it at Apple, but I know people who
do. You're absolutely right. And the interesting thing is, that's actually a very interesting case, because what you've done is you've chosen literally the most personal item you own. I mean, this guy is with me all the time, except in the shower.
Right.
I mean, it sits on my nightstand when I'm in bed. It's on my desk when I'm working. It's in my pocket when I'm out and about. It's literally the so because it's such a personal item to people, that does so much. People take real umbrage, and they get very I think there are better things to sort of get hot under the collar about, unless of course you work for Apple or Samsung. Then of course that's your bread and butter. But
I know it's a little crazy, I have to say. I mean, like,
just a little. Look, let them have their people get to do that.
Choose what you want based on what you want, but taking pot shots at other people for making a different choice is just a little over the top, as far as I'm concerned. And they do it, and with so much emotion involved. Like, if it was just, you like white t-shirts? No, I only wear black t-shirts. But like, this is so emotional.
That's why I said people. There are better things for people to get hot under the collar about. But if that's if that's all they got, let them have it. It's a better outlet than
I think it's good that people need to get hot under the collar about something. So
someone's got to get passionate about something, right?
Okay.
Don't they?
No, but if you're going to be passionate about something, be passionate for something, not passionate against something.
Okay, well, that's something we've brought up several times, right?
Yes.
That's the very nature of it is that we vote is that more and more people are voting against somebody as opposed to voting for somebody.
Yeah. I mean, and that's going to happen in politics, but it's just a little weird when it spills over into what phone we use.
Yeah, I think that's an unusual example.
Yeah.
It's
one I've observed a lot lately. So.
Oh yeah. Well, you can't unobserve it.
Yeah. Exactly. I think we're out of time for today.
Yes.
Next week, of course, will be the day after the election, so probably we'll have some election talk next week. Check us out at politicalfixradio.com. You can watch some archives of the video, behind-the-scenes video, as well as listen to some of the radio shows. Have a good week. On behalf of myself, Jay Amernick, and Rick Raddatz, we'll be back with you next week on The Political Fix.
Thank you for listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. On behalf of Rick Raddatz, Jay Amernick, and myself, Heather Valgoss, we're glad you chose to get your fix with us. We need reform to fix this country, and incentive reform is what will make a difference. The five economies and resources laid out in Pentonomics and the strategies we call cap and prioritize are the focus of Rick's vision of the optimal political future. Every week we talk about the answers we've dug up among ourselves and with political experts who have the ability to make change happen. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, at politicalfixradio.com.